Fire danger risk in Missoula County has been raised to moderate. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Reporter Ruth Eddy talks about how to deal with outside jobs in the heat. Capital reporter Dan Boyes talks about health clinics that provide free primary care services for state employees. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with Montana Tech's principal investigator about restoration ecology projects. As of today, fire danger risk has been elevated to moderate in Missoula County. And according to the Missoula County Fire Protection Association, or MCFPA, and federal, state, and local wildland fire suppression agencies, open burning in Missoula County will close July 3rd. MCFPA President Matt Hall says the public can still have campfires, even though outdoor burning has been closed. So Montana firefighters are supporting New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado in suppression efforts, limiting local resources. To help prevent fires, MCFPA Secretary and Treasurer Chris Johnson asked campers to do the same thing that all wildland firefighters do.
Before we leave a fire and call it dead out, we take our gloves off and we put our hands down into the coals, and it's not cold enough to the touch, it's not cold enough to leave. So that's the biggest thing is build your campfire in a good, safe spot where it's not going to get away, and don't ever leave it unattended until it's cold to the touch.
He says the West fire season is long enough.
We don't need a lot of human-caused fires to further stress our people. So the safer we all are with fire, the safer we're all going to be as firefighters.
And in other news from around the state, it's a new month with a new record temperature. For air-conditioned employees, the heat doesn't mean much. Reporter Ruth Eddy found out what 100-degree weather means for those that work outside.
I'm Kendall Meyer from Missoula, Montana, 21 years old. I'm just working for Accent Green, doing some landscaping, some mowing. I just like being outside. I like the sun. I don't like being cooped up, I guess, in a little building, so.
It's too hot out here.
His coworker, Andrew Parsons, puts both his hands under his shirt and then brings the shirt up to his face.
It's a classic. It's been around since about 1860, I think.
Yeah.
Back
sweat
in the day.
With the shirt.
You gotta practice, though. You gotta get it down.
The worst job? Roofing, because you're up on the roof and the sun's close to you, so. Maybe that.
Yeah, it would be pretty rough.
Or construction.
Roofing and construction. Concrete, something.
And all that.
Yeah.
I like it. I don't mind the elements.
Are you already picked up on that one?
Beats an office. Pushing papers. Nope, if I had to work in an office or behind a desk, I'd be pounding my head on the table. I'm not an office guy.
Brad Harrison has been working construction for just 1 week.
Yeah, this is my second Monday.
His coworker, Cody Lynn, has been doing it 11 years and explains the dress code.
Steel-toe boots, high-vis, orange, yellows, reds, something that's visible, hard hats, no shorts, gotta wear pants.
The landscaper's cargo shorts and tank tops wouldn't fly at the construction site. Lynn says he's gotten pretty used to it, and besides, digging holes and putting water pipes in on a hot day isn't nearly as bad as
asphalt paving, because you're standing on top 300-degree material. It's another one of those you get used to it.
But it's hot.
You get used to it. If you notice, a lot of those guys, they when it starts to cool down on any day colder than like 70 degrees, they're all wearing sweatshirts and long sleeves.
Uh-huh.
Keeps them used to it.
Just like his coworker and the landscaping boys, Lynn likes working outside.
I love it. New scenery every day.
There is one other thing the landscapers and the construction workers had in common.
Bring water.
We drink a lot of water. Stay hydrated, and that's, you know, that gets us through the day, I guess.
Keep hydrated and sweat.
And water isn't just for those with jobs in the sun. With high temperatures, it's important for everyone to be staying hydrated. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Ruth Eddy.
Governor Steve Bullock is telling the public to wait for the details of President Barack Obama's climate change plan, while assuring them that the energy production will remain a major economic driver in the state. Obama's goal of limiting carbon dioxide emissions has put Democratic leaders in energy-producing states such as Montana in a bind. They are caught between bellicose Republican statements of a war on coal and emboldened environmentalists who want swift action. Obama's plan announced last week would include executive action to place limits on carbon pollution from the new and existing power plants, while expanding development of renewable energy. Republican leaders in Montana predict dire consequences, calling the plan a war on energy and a job killer. Others say the president's announcement means greater opportunities to develop the state's renewable resources.
A convicted sex offender has escaped from the Montana State Prison in Deer Lodge. Prison spokeswoman Linda Moudry says 42-year-old Dean Randolph Jess escaped at about 11 a.m. today. Officials say he was working for motor vehicle maintenance on a service call when he left prison property. The vehicle he was in was found on the southern edge of the prison ranch. Moudry says officials do not know where he may be traveling or what mode of transportation he is using. He was wearing a blue shirt and pants. Jess is described as being Caucasian, 5 feet 10 inches tall, and weighing about 180 pounds. He has green eyes and a shaved head. Anyone with information on his location is asked to call local law enforcement. Jess was sentenced in Park County.
Helena's government-run health clinic for state employees is seeing much more use than originally expected. It provides free primary care services to the capital city's 11,000 state workers and their dependents. The clinic was launched last year by former Democratic Governor Brian Schweitzer as a way to improve overall employee health and save money for the state's self-funded health insurance plan. Capital reporter Dan Boyce says so far those objectives seem to be happening, and officials say visitation has been more than 75% above initial projections.
Joanne Howard works the front desk at the State Employee Health Clinic, and it's another busy day.
We're actually between 75 to 80 patients, including our lab patients.
State employees quickly fill in the weekday 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. visitation slots.
Before, it was a lot of the flu people were coming in for, but, you know, sprains, fractures, physicals, just all-around wellness.
The clinic has been expanding its hours to fit in everyone. It's a tightly run operation, though. Staff say the average wait time is about 5 minutes. Director of Operations and Physician Assistant Jimmy Barnwell says patients are responding this well because the format of the clinic removes a lot of the barriers people often feel in going to the doctor, like cost.
We don't charge any out-of-pocket expenses when people come to see us, so no co-pays, deductibles, co-insurances.
The state government is paying for the total cost of all those visits. The state also contracts with a private company called Care Here to operate the clinic. The state pays the salaries of the physicians, nurses, and other staff. The state is paying for all these new expenses, and Republicans last year faulted then-Governor Schweitzer for moving ahead with such an idea without legislative approval, although it was not needed. But current Governor Steve Bullock's budget director, Dan Villa, says the budget set aside for employee health care is already saving money.
About $1.5 million over a 10-month period.
And he explains it this way.
You can see the direct savings from what the cost would have been due to prior costs outside of the clinic with the costs inside of the clinic.
A patient's visit to the employee health clinic costs the state a little over $100. But when an employee visits a doctor outside the clinic, out in the private sector, that visit costs the state an average of almost $190, nearly twice as much. Multiply that difference over almost 24,000 visits to the clinic so far, that's a big part of the savings. And that's short term. Looking further ahead, Russ Hill.
My name is Russ Hill. I'm the administrator of the Healthcare and Benefits Division for the state of Montana.
Hill looks at improving employee health. He says since the clinic opened, more than 650 people have come in who had not seen a doctor for at least 2 years. And the clinic is catching a lot of all the patients who have come in.
600 people that have diabetes that didn't know they had diabetes.
1,300 people have high cholesterol.
High blood pressure, where we found 1,600 people.
And the clinic has diagnosed 2,600 patients as obese. Physicians give all these patients the option of speaking with a dietitian and exercise physiologist in the clinic's wellness program.
The goals are not to look like a supermodel or run a marathon. The goals are to establish healthy eating habits.
Maybe start a moderate exercise routine. Hill says it's in the state of Montana's interest as an employer to get these employees and their families healthier, to avoid expensive emergency room visits and other costs of these chronic diseases down the line. Clinic Operations Director and PA Jimmy Barnwell says that's all very rewarding for him.
As frustrating as medical care can be for patients, sometimes it's just as frustrating for the providers as well, because there's a lot of times that we identify and see things in patients that we want to work with them on, but because of the barriers in the fee-for-service model and things like that, we're just not able to.
In this model, those patients might be more willing to come back and work on those conditions if they don't have to pay for it. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Montana opened another smaller state employee health clinic in Billings at the beginning of June. Other clinics are in the works for the Deer Lodge Valley and potentially Missoula and Bozeman as the state enters into negotiations to make clinics available to Montana University System employees.
Governor Steve Bullock's former campaign is rebutting allegations from a Billings businessman that the campaign illegally coordinated activities with third-party groups. James Pennington filed the complaint in mid-March, saying the campaign and several groups wrongly coordinated activities through political vendor Hilltop Public Solutions. The complaint relies on financial disclosure filings with the Commissioner of Political Practice, showing campaign staffers spoke with Hilltop agents that were, quote, supposedly involved in otherwise independent campaigning, unquote. It is legal for candidates to coordinate spending with third-party groups. It is seen as a potential way to circumvent campaign contribution limits. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports that attorneys for Hilltop and the Bullock campaign deny Pennington's charges. They say the campaign simply was using the same vendor that was providing services to many Democratic-aligned third-party groups.
A former Libertarian congressional candidate from Victor has been reported missing. The Ravalli County Sheriff's Office is asking for help in locating 53-year-old David Philip Kaiser. He was last seen at about 6 p.m. Friday and was reported missing Saturday. Kaiser is a white man who is 5 feet 4 inches tall and about 200 pounds with blonde hair and hazel eyes. He was last seen wearing a dark blue polo shirt, blue jeans, and red and white tennis shoes. He may be traveling in a black and silver 2005 Chevrolet Trailblazer with Montana Patriot license plates, NNBB00. Kaiser ran for the U.S. House in 2012 against Republican Steve Daines and Democrat Kim Gillen. He received 4% of the vote in last November's general election.
Montana Tech is spearheading a project that organizers say will improve the quantity and diversity of native plants on the Butte Hill. In tonight's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Montana Tech's principal investigator with the Restoration Ecology Project, Christine Douglas, explains how they continued funding for the Montana Plant Propagation Center by the State Natural Resource Damage Program will help build sustainable plant communities on the caps of the Butte Hill. Of course, this story actually has its origins in the 1800s.
The mining just began with lots and lots of little mines and lots of smelting on the ground. And the smelting by the 1900s had pretty much killed all the vegetation on the hill. And so by 1920, there was some outcry by the public, and we began to get some regulation, and smelting was eventually moved over to Anaconda. But by then, the vegetation pretty much had been killed, and the holes and the mine waste had accumulated, and there was a lot of contamination at the surface from the smelting and the mine waste dumps. And so then, you know, that continued sitting there until the Superfund law and the opportunity for the state to engage with the Superfund program through the Natural Resource Damage Program for remediation, which activities have been going on for about 30 years in Butte. Remediation has pushed the contamination here and there and covered it, and so now there's clean soil at the surface and vegetation growing on what we call the caps. Under the, you know, the repository of the contamination is under the caps. Mm-hmm. So there are repositories covered with clean soil and vegetation, and at this point, the restoration can begin, and that remediation brings the environment to human health standards, but it does not restore to natural ecological conditions. So restoration is the next phase, which is now beginning. Restoration there's money, we can restore the remediated sites to some natural ecological function.
And Ms. Douglas,
that's where we are.
What does it look like, and what potentially in the future because of this could it look like?
So right now, the Butte Hill has some nice graded hillsides covered with a mix of grass and alfalfa. Some of it is like 20 years old. Some of it, they're still just finishing up. So there are these various sites that is primarily grass and some alfalfa. That particular mix does not really provide for ecological function. And so, of course, it will happen over time naturally. But with restoration, we have the opportunity to hasten this project and bring more plant diversity into these grassy sites. Plant diversity will then bring in insect diversity and bird diversity and small mammal diversity, and we will have the appearance of something more like natural meadows. So my project is for the vegetation, bring back wildflowers and shrub species, so that, I don't know exactly how to say it, so we just encourage the continued development of more natural-looking and functioning ecosystems.
You use the phrase ecological function, so that, as you've just said, implies something other than aesthetic concerns.
Exactly. So we're not making gardens. It will look better because I think the human eye likes to look at a natural meadow. But the point is to bring back ecological function so that it's more sustainable. We will be less likely to have to spend time maintaining it, you know, doing weed control. The natural diversity will, in fact, be weed resistant, so then you have to do less weed control. The species we are using are drought tolerant and cold drought tolerant, and so they'll remain on the hill and disperse and continue expanding across the hillsides.
What kind of plants specifically are we talking about?
Oh, my gosh. I have a list of about 120 species.
How about three?
So, okay, we start out with early spring flowers like Douglasia and Phlox. Then there are summer flowers, lupine, mountain dandelion, local weeds, and vetches. Those are legumes that provide nitrogen-fixing capacity in the soil. Then the fall flowers are asters and goldenrod, and there's a little rumex that provides some red color on the hill.
Oh, it sounds actually beautiful, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is. You know, I mean, it will just look more natural. There will be some blooming flowers more or less all summer, so that provides, you know, flowers for the insects and then seeds for other insects and small mammals. So then you end up getting, you know, like I said, more of a functioning ecosystem.
It'll be weird not to see, oh, knapweed and toad flax and all the rest of it.
yeah, exactly. Oh, I think we can reduce the opportunity for those weeds to come across the Butte Hill. I think it's going to be a very beautiful place. I think it's better already.
Where does the seed stock come from?
It's very close. We're doing all of our seed collecting, almost all of our seed collecting within a mile of Butte. So in the hills around the Big Butte, the East Ridge, Timber Butte, just south of town. So we're collecting very close, so we know that these seeds are adapted to this environmental condition.
So how much then do you and your friends and colleagues do, and how much does Mother Nature do? You guys do the initial work, and then Mother Nature kicks in and propagates the rest of it, I guess.
Well, we have to go out and find the seeds, know when they're available to collect. We collect them. We have to know which ones have to be treated. About half the seeds have to have a cold treatment, some of them up to 3 to 6 months before they'll germinate.
Oh, I'm sorry, a cold treatment meaning hardening? What does that mean?
Well, you put them in a refrigerator in moist conditions. So we put them in little bags of peat so they stay moist and they stay cold, and that mimics having spent a year or two on the ground freezing and freeze thaw, and so then it allows them to germinate when you bring them out and they warm up.
Huh.
So then we actually plant the seeds, and we start some of them in containers, so we can plant out containers, but we also, our trick is what we call forb sods. So we're building small patches, about a meter square, with a diverse number of species in each one. We started in the greenhouse, then we put it outside to harden it after the seeds have germinated and the plants are growing. Then when it's hardened, then we move them out onto the butyl in bigger patches, so we can put like 10 to 30 together in a patch. So we are actually building patches of natural meadow on the hill. And those will act as dispersal islands. As the plants mature and the seeds are available, then they'll blow out into the adjoining grassland and eventually disperse and make themselves bigger. So that's what we are doing. And then Mother Nature takes over by blowing the seeds across the hillsides and the insects moving them and caching them, and then some of them germinate. And so then Mother Nature does take over.
What does an ambitious project like this cost? And again, where does the funding come from?
So the funding comes from the Natural Resource Damage Program. And this phase of it, we have $1 million for 8 years. And this is the sixth year I've been working on this project. We started out with $300,000, which built us a new state-of-the-art greenhouse to work in, and a year of funding to get started. Then a second grant for $600,000 to continue exactly working on collecting the seed, starting the seed, and moving it out onto the sites in demonstration dispersal islands. Most of that money goes to salaries, because we collect the seed for free, but we have to have, it's a very intensive hand operation. So that was a big enough success. They were willing to fund us for 8 more years.
Are there any teaching opportunities here, learning opportunities for Montana Tech students?
At this point, there are. In the past 6 years, I've had students help me, and they've done undergraduate research projects and senior research projects. So there have been a number of students work with me and use this project for their educational career. At this point, we have such a good track record. Montana Tech agreed to coordinate, and so Montana Tech and the Natural Resource Damage Program are each funding one half of a tenure-track position. So we now have a brand-new tenure-track professor who will start this fall teaching restoration ecology and helping me run the program and develop a restoration ecology certification program for Montana Tech. I am very excited. I am very pleased. I think we've demonstrated very good success, and we have very good support. And now we have 8 more years to continue, and a brand new professor who will come in, and he's young, he has good experience, he's eager to work on this project, he's had 3 or 4 years of teaching experience. So I think that we're set to move forward and turn this demonstration into something that will really change the face of Butte.
I've been speaking with Chris Douglas, and listen, I very much appreciate your time, and best of luck with this.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
In tonight's weather forecast, for west of the Continental Divide, a heat advisory is in effect until tomorrow night. Tonight will be mostly clear with lows in the 50s. Tomorrow calls for mostly sunny skies with a slight chance of showers and highs in the 90s. For central Montana, tonight expect mostly clear skies with lows around 55 to 65 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny. Highs will be around 90 to 100 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight calls for mostly clear skies and isolated thunderstorms. In the evening, lows will be in the upper 50s. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon and highs around 85 to 95 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
Both the proponents and opponents of the Keystone Pipeline were encouraged by President Obama's recent statement that he would approve the pipeline as long as it did not exacerbate greenhouse gas emissions. Those supporting this pipeline that would carry the bitumen from Alberta tar sands to American oil refineries on the Gulf Coast claimed that the U.S. Department of State had already concluded that there will be no significant increases in greenhouse gas emissions. So the president must have been saying that he will approve the pipeline. Critics of the carbon-intensive character of extracting petroleum-like fluids from these tar sands say that producing and burning these especially carbon-intensive fossil fuels could force climate change past a tipping point. To them, the president was just warning that he was not going to approve the Keystone Pipeline. The dispute here is not primarily centered on whether producing petroleum products from the tar sands is more carbon-intensive than conventional petroleum production. The fossil fuels contained in those sands, as the tar sand name makes clear, coat the sands with a sticky tar-like substance. One cannot just pump it out of the ground and send it off to an oil refinery to make liquid fuels for our automobiles. Instead, two steps have to be taken first. The thick and sticky bitumen has to be separated from the sands, water, and clay minerals in which it's embedded. This is done by burning other fossil fuels to heat up those tar sands so that the bitumen runs off. But that does not produce a petroleum-like product. It is too thick to move through a pipeline and not ready to be used at existing oil refineries. The bitumen has to be processed, again using heat, to turn it into something that can travel through existing pipelines, ready to be refined into the usual mix of products such as gasoline, diesel fuel, and fuel oil. These extra steps burn up energy and boost the greenhouse gas emissions. The energy companies that are mining and processing the tar sands are well aware of this problem and have formed a consortium to develop new technologies to reduce the energy intensiveness, and therefore the greenhouse gas emissions, of their current tar sand processes. So the debate is not over the energy intensiveness of different ways of obtaining petroleum-like products, although there are some interesting problems to be resolved there. The debate is primarily over what will happen if the Keystone Pipeline is not approved. The impact of the proposed pipeline is the difference in the outcomes if the pipeline is approved compared to what is likely to happen if it is not. Strangely enough, the proponents of the pipeline assert that not much will change from an energy perspective if the pipeline simply is not built. They assert that tar sands bitumen will reach commercial markets and be used whether or not the pipeline is built. Since they expect the same amount of tar sands bitumen to reach energy markets even if the Keystone Pipeline is not built, they claim that the greenhouse gas emissions will be the same with or without the pipeline. So the president should simply approve it. There is a worldwide demand for more petroleum, they argue, and one way or another, Alberta's tar sand bitumen will flow into it. Something seems left out of this position. Why would the energy companies push so heavily to build the Keystone Pipeline if there are lots of alternative ways to get the bitumen to market that could be used instead? The environmental critics of the Keystone Pipeline answer that question. They assert, as you would expect energy companies sponsoring the Keystone Pipeline to have asserted, that this particular pipeline is crucial to the low-cost distribution of tar sands bitumen to world energy markets. Without that low-cost transportation route, the tar sands operation would not be able to expand anywhere near as much as producers hope, because they would face a much more limited market if they have to sell to local Canadian refineries and local Canadian markets. The Keystone Pipeline is the least cost, most secure, and most profitable way to connect the tar sands to world energy markets. That, in turn, suggests that any alternative, such as shipping by rail or building a pipeline to the East Coast through Canada, would be much more costly, less reliable, and less profitable. The market accessible to tar sands bitumen would shrink. As a result, less of the tar sands bitumen would reach world markets. Petroleum products and the world market would be more expensive than they would be if this new Canadian Saudi Arabia does not flood the world with additional petroleum-like products. In a world of higher bitumen costs and petroleum prices, less petroleum and tar sands products will be consumed, and greenhouse gas emissions will be lower. There's no doubt that facilitating the delivery of a very large new petroleum supply to world markets will tend to have that outcome. Put the other way around, building the Keystone Pipeline will exacerbate greenhouse gas emissions. That is, it will fail President Obama's test, and he will have to reject the pipeline. But no one is likely to be satisfied with the purely conceptual analysis of the proponents and opponents of this pipeline, given how much is at stake. That is why the EPA has insisted that more careful and detailed analysis and study and modeling be done to lay out exactly how the construction and operation of the Keystone Pipeline will impact national and world energy markets and associated greenhouse gas emissions. Obama should support EPA in demanding that such a real economic analysis be carried out.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.